Hello, and welcome back to the HBAN podcast, your go-to podcast for longevity policy discussion. I'm your host, Dylan Livingston. Today, we're excited to be joined by Michael Ringel, Chief Operating Officer of Life Biosciences. In this episode, I wanted to discuss how Michael got involved with the longevity space and the exciting developments of Life Biosciences, which is looking to start human clinical trials with its epigenetic reprogramming asset within the next year. Without further ado, here's Michael Ringel.
Live long and prosper.
Michael Ringel, thank you so much for joining us today for an episode of the HBAN podcast. I'm really excited to sit down and have the opportunity to talk with you.
Thanks for having me, Dylan.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the first question our audience probably wants to hear about is how you got into the aging field. That's how I like to start these conversations. It's different for everyone. Sometimes it's like a traumatic experience, sometimes it's just a scientific interest. What's your path to the longevity and aging field?
Yeah, mine goes back pretty far. My father told me about caloric restriction when I was a kid growing up in the 70s. I'm not quite sure how he knew about it, though obviously, Clyde McKay's work dates back to the 30s, and there's even work before that. For whatever reason, I thought, well, that's pretty interesting, but difficult, right? Maybe not most fun thing to do. And even beyond that, just do you have the discipline really to enforce it on yourself? I was doing my PhD in the 90s, early 90s, and that's when Cynthia Kenyon's work came out on DAF2 and worms, which was not the very first, but nearly the first paper to show significant lifespan extension from single gene mutation. And it was pretty interesting. It was DAF2 is a diapause gene. I was working on diapause, the evolution of diapause at the time, had logged that away. It's not an accident, by the way, that it is a diapause gene, which we can come back to. But that became the germ of, hey, okay, there's a way to make some scientific progress here, which of course we knew because it's an evolved trait, it's under regulation. So there must be ways to manipulate it. There are plenty of immortal species, especially among bacteria, as in they don't age, obviously they do die. You know, we knew there was a scientifically tractable question, but it was nice to see it in a paper. And then continue to stay connected to the field. And in 2019, I can talk about it because it was a public tender. I did a project while at BCG, where I was for 25 years. And that project was for the Royal Court of Saudi Arabia on, is this aging space real? And if so, should we do anything about it? Did work with that group where we made some recommendations around there is some pseudoscience, some charlatanism to be wary of, but there's also some very real science. And there's an opportunity for an entity to really help make progress through early stage support, both grants and investments. And that materialized into Evolution, which has been fantastic to watch grow under the amazing leadership of Dr. Mahmoud Khan and the team there, which is fantastic top to bottom, which has helped catapult the field forward. But it was also a kick in the butt for me to say, this is an area of real interest for me and it's time to make a move. And so I started to look around for the exact right move and ultimately came to Life Bio earlier this year.
Beautiful, beautiful. Kudos to you for helping kickstart evolution because I agree with you. I think it's a cascade of interest into the field now, and I think it's a snowball effect. And not to mention the large amount of money that they have in putting towards projects in this space. That's always very helpful, especially at times like right now. And so I thank you for that. I have another question. So you got your PhD and then you went to Harvard Law School. You might be the most educated in terms of college degrees person I've had on the HBAN podcast. Three of them. Wow. Can you tell me a little bit about your law background and how that's influenced your career and where you see your law background play a part in the longevity ecosystem, specifically at Life?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I remember when I was coming out of school and interviewing, and people were like, are you a perpetual student? Do you want a real job? Of course, now that I've been in a real job for more than 25 years, I think people are, that's probably forgotten, but it's interesting. I did the PhD through the helpful guidance of a mentor. It's really the other way around. Like, I was always going to be a lawyer. My father had been a lawyer, I had a brother who was a lawyer. I just thought it was the path that I was going to take. And I was an undergrad in biology, and my mentor said, you seem to like this stuff. Why don't you stick at it? That coupled with the helpful support of a grant-making agency, the National Science Foundation, led me to say, okay, you know what? I do this stuff. Let me spend some time getting a degree. It was actually a degree purely for pleasure, like not with intent for use, but for intellectual curiosity. And then I went and did the law degree. And then, as planned, right, I in fact had deferred enrolled, so it was like locked in almost. And then as I was coming out of it, I was making the decision around what is it that I wanted to do, and I realized that actually I cared more about the former than the latter. And I wanted to find a way to continue to use my science degree, and spent a fair bit of time after that working in consulting for biopharma companies, all around how you make the R&D process better and what pathways to invest in, and all sorts of really important questions in terms of helping drive human health forward. So the law degree ended up being footnote. I'm glad I did it, right? It's great people. It was also a fun period of life. But it was also something that I realized, oh, I've gone down that alley and it's not the alley I want to keep down. And so I backed out and headed down another path.
That a footnote law degree from Harvard, that's something. That's
Yeah, I got to tell you, most lawyers will tell you learn nothing in law school and everything on the job. And it's definitely, I think, true for me. I wouldn't trust myself making any legal recommendation whatsoever. And in fact, I let my bar lapse 20 years ago. I'm not licensed.
Gotcha. Do you see that experience and that kind of that pathway that you took as being helpful in you apply it in your current role at as COO at Life Biosciences at all?
I know just enough to be dangerous. I know enough to ask where the questions are that I to ask, but not anywhere near enough to know the answers to them.
That's why you got things like ChatGPT now.
Exactly. And we have amazing general counsel and chief administrative officer who is where all those questions go.
So tell me a little bit about, or tell our audience about your time at BCG. What kind of biopharma did you advise? Was there any sort of interaction with the longevity field? I know Boston is a hub for longevity science, specifically Harvard and MIT. Did you interact with the field at all there? Was it mostly traditional biotech?
Yeah. So first of all, fantastic place, great people, very hardworking, and working on sometimes some very important questions. Really enjoyed my time there. Lots of work in how to make biopharma better. And it's a really difficult question. Like, it's very hard to figure out what the right things to target are and how best to target them. And it's not an engineering science. It's somewhere between that and an art. And how you optimize that system is actually not trivial, and it matters because it's how many medicines every year are we going to be able to bring to patients. Fun stuff. There was not a lot on longevity science, or let's say the use of aging pathways to address age-related disease, because it's still very much an emerging area. There's some great stuff happening, but it's largely in early stage biotech and VC supported kind of activities and back in academia, right? Grant supported activities, which is not the focus of a company like BCG or any of the other kind of large consulting companies that work essentially with companies that are $1 billion in revenue and up. It's too early to be hitting their radar commercially. It is on the radar as something that is a trend that matters. I actually started the kind of longevity and aging interest group within BCG, and there's lots of people who are interested in it personally and see that it will be eventually commercially relevant. And so there's some ramping up there. Your guess is as good as mine as to how long before this gets into big pharma, but I think we're trying to do everything we can to push it as quickly as possible.
Yeah. That's what A4LI was created to do. And I think companies like Life Biosciences, and there's a few that are approaching phase one, two, and three, right? And so I hope sooner rather than later, I would like to see these therapeutics on the market for my parents and my family and me.
There's an unbelievably powerful value proposition for pharma, which is if you believe the geroscience hypothesis, and there's a lots of reason to believe it, and the geroscience hypothesis says the incidence of most disease is impacted by your age, right? Dementia, cardiovascular disease, cancer, et cetera, they go up almost exponentially with age. If you could modulate the rate of aging, you would have a therapy prevention is something that would affect the course of disease across multiple diseases simultaneously. In another word, it's a pipeline and a pill. And that's incredibly invaluable from the big pharma perspective. And we're seeing it come now to fruition with the GLP-1s, right? People who don't understand the geroscience hypothesis have been confused why these medicines have therapeutic benefit in so many disparate diseases. GLP-1s are hitting one of the core pathways of aging biology. Not at all surprising that they have benefit in not just weight loss and diabetes, but also heart failure, chronic kidney disease, emerging evidence we'll see in cancer, neurodegeneration, and so on. But that the ability to have a medicine like that is something that every pharma wants. And so the thesis around these kinds of medicines that by modulating the rate of aging can affect many diseases simultaneously is something that is super valuable for them. It's up to
Absolutely.
us now in the biotechs to prove it out.
Absolutely. There's a general sentiment that longevity therapeutic development goes against what pharma's interests are. And I don't believe that either. And I see you shaking your head. I agree with you. Can you talk a little bit about why that is, why they're completely compatible, and why pharma will
Yeah, there's no sinister motive in pharma, which I think is often ascribed to it. People there care about human health. They really do. And the same people as you and me, right? They're researchers who are trying to address disease, and they also care about economics of return. And coming up with medicines that make people healthier, there's unbelievable value in that. Very, very serious economists have estimated economic value of something like a health span extension. So first Murphy and Topol at University of Chicago, they wrote a National Bureau of Economic Research paper. They looked at the impact of health span gains and lifespan gains that have already happened and calculated billions of value. Goldman and colleagues at Rand Corporation did an analysis where they showed trillions of dollars of value in a very small lifespan extension, starting at age 50, a slight shift to the mortality curve that then also phased in over a very slow 20-year period. So a very modest increase. And then most recently, Andrew Scott at London Business School showed from a 10-year extension of health span, no lifespan effect, something like a $300 trillion value. And value is comprised of multiple things. There is some, let's say, non-dollar value in the value of statistical life, like how much we actually would like to live longer and better, healthier. But there's also like pure dollar value in as people are living healthier and longer, they're driving the economy. They're, if they want to, working longer. They're acting as consumers longer. Both of those things drive increased GDP. And they're also delaying and probably shortening the time that they need healthcare support and other social support, which means there's fewer cost drains. So you add all that up, you get this enormous economic value, which is available from if someone were to produce these kinds of medicines. And of course, pharma companies that produce them would accrue some of those rents. And so there's a huge economic incentive in addition to the moral imperative to work on this. And I think it's just a matter of time before pharma gets engaged on it. They tend to wait for proof of concept type studies. And the GLP-1s have started to open that door. And I think we're close to a few more pieces of evidence falling into place to really drive real action.
Absolutely. That's the number one thing that I lead with when I speak to members on the Hill, staff, is the economic benefit of this whole thing. The conversation in Washington is really centered right now around cutting the budget. And we're going around cutting all this discretionary funding. But the real cost to the government is Medicare and Social Security. And the only way to really decrease the cost of Medicare and Social Security is by extending healthy lifespan. And I think it's an appropriate time for this field to be growing with this conversation in Washington happening. And that's probably the number one talking point that we should be pushing forward as an industry, right?
It's really well said. And it's also 180 degrees to the intuition that most people have. I think most people think if we make people live longer, how is that going to hurt the coffers of Social Security and healthcare? And it's actually, as you pointed out, it's the solution to the gray wave because people, implicit in it, is people are healthier longer and therefore able to delay these expenses and increase the inputs that they create.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to shift a little bit to talk about Life Biosciences. You started out with them back in 2018, and then you were an advisor, and now you're COO. And so, can you tell us a little bit about why Life Biosciences? What drew you to their mission and their platform?
Yeah, I've already talked about generally why interested in geroscience and the value that I think it can bring. So you can check that box, right? And then your question, I think, is why within that, the particular area that life is focusing on and why life bio itself. So as part of that work that I mentioned for Laurel Court, I did a real scan of what are the potential areas of aging biology that can have the most impact. And it became clear to me that there are lots of valuable areas that you can intervene. We just talked about nutrient sensing pathway with the GLP-1s, which is going to add a decade, maybe 2 decades of health span, but probably a year, maybe 2 years of lifespan. If you look at the impact of caloric restriction across species, it's a log linear decline with how long-lived the species is. And there's a very good evolutionary reason to expect exactly what we see empirically, which predicts we'll maybe see a couple year effect in humans as opposed to a 50% effect in worms. You can also draw that line by looking at different human populations with amount of caloric restriction, sumo wrestlers versus mainland Japanese versus Okinawans, who are at the limit of what or historically were at the limit of what you could consume. And you get that same kind of, yeah, there's a 2 3 year lifespan effect here. So if we're thinking about what biology is it that could actually fundamentally change lifespan and health span, there's really nothing out there that I've seen other than partial epigenetic reprogramming, which taps into some very simple biology, which is babies are born young, no matter the age of their parents. And Shinya Monaco was able to make the realization and published a paper in 2006 that won the Nobel Prize in 2012, that if I tap into that biology, I can make a stem cell that completely resets its identity, but also is completely young. So Dolly the sheep was born as a baby, even though it came from an adult cell. And it's now been shown you can do that repeatedly. Take a clone from a clone every time from an adult, and what you get is a baby over and over again. So there's biology built into us that allows cells to completely rejuvenate. And that's profound, right? Now, the problem is you can't do that in vivo, because when you do full epigenetic reprogramming, you not only reset the age of the cell, you reset its identity, and you don't want to lose the identity of your cells. There's both the functional loss, but also risk of cancer. And the key insight came about with the 2020 paper published cover of Nature that you can use partial epigenetic reprogramming to avoid things like any NANOG expression, which is a key marker of pluripotency, avoid the formation of teratomas. In that study, they actually reduced the incidence of teratomas. So something that's safe, that's not going all the way back to pluripotency, but effective. It's rejuvenating the cell, it's improving tissue, and it led to organismal improvements in function, and in this case, vision from after following a nerve crush. And that is technology that is fascinating, right? And incredibly powerful if we can get it to work in terms of its implications.
Absolutely.
So the fact that life has that as its core technology, to me, set an incredible long-term vision for what it could become. But that alone wasn't enough, because I'm a very hard-nosed biotech valuation-focused person, and without a short term, the long term is meaningless. But the fact that life is within a year going to be in the clinic with a molecule that has already a great preclinical data package, beautiful data in non-human primates, as well as other animal models showing safety and efficacy, gave me real confidence that we've got a short-term path to real therapeutic benefit for patients. In this case, our indications are NAION, non-arteritic anterior ischemic optic neuropathy, which is basically a stroke that harms the optic nerve, and glaucoma, which I think is a better known disease, both of which have tremendous unmet need. And the chance to be able to help patients in that and bring better care to them, as well as obviously make a return for the shareholders by doing that, is something that really finished out the story for me. So I'm super excited to be here and really excited to see what we can do.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, I think you talked a little bit about my next question here, but Life is noted for being, I think, the first epigenetic reprogramming company entering human clinical trials, which is very impressive. I've seen the fanfare in the media around it. So can you give us the timeline a little bit? You mentioned a year from about now is when you're entering the clinic. The first indication is vision, glaucoma, like you mentioned. What's the long-term vision also?
Yeah, so our intent, as you described, is to be in phase one clinical trials within a year. We've had our pre-IND meeting. We've run our GLP tox package. So we feel confident around that. Phase one trials are designed to determine safety and to some degree dosing. You are dosing patients, so we will get some anecdotal information around efficacy, but nothing that you could use as any regulatory perspective. It would maybe help us in some of our own internal decision making. We expect that to be, if successful, followed up by phase two and three in the sort of normal course of action. That is just our lead asset. We are not a vision company only. It is a very good place to start with the technology, but there are lots of other age-related diseases. We estimate more than half of the total global burden of disease is in age-related disease, and even some that aren't technically counted there probably fall into that when you think about infections where susceptibility to infection is, obviously related to age. So there's lots and lots of places we can play, and we're being very thoughtful in the sequencing of follow-on indications.
Do you have an indication you could tell our audience, or is that top secret?
We have some initial activities, but we're not disclosing where we're working on those.
Okay. Top secret. All right. I'm excited to see when the announcement comes out. So when I first heard about you, Michael, I heard you speak on policy at ARDD. And so we talked about drug development timelines, mentioned it's going to go the similar course that other drug development trials take. My question to you is, how can government policy accelerate timelines and get patients cures faster than normally? Because I think that's a goal of everyone in this industry to see not only better therapeutics be developed, but also therapeutics accessible in a reasonable timeline. So, do you have any thoughts on the policy end? How can the government be a player and an accelerator in this space?
Yeah, so there's a lot that the government can do on the clinical end, as you described, an appropriate balance of ensuring safety while and efficacy while also ensuring access. And I think the FDA thinks very carefully around how to calibrate that. And I'm not one of these advocates who thinks that they've done a poor job of that historically. There's always a balance. Obviously, in conditions where there's more of an unmet need, the shift is more towards trying to get therapies on market. And that's been the historical precedent as well within the FDA. The other thing that government can do is well upstream of clinic, which is in the research space, and it's incredibly important. We talked about grant making. Support for this field is something that, in order for scientists to do the work, they need funding. And there's tremendous economic value to doing that. I'm very much a free market economist by training, and free market economists by training know that there are market imperfections, and those imperfections are externalities. Classic negative externality is pollution, where if my pollution is that cost of that is shared by many people, I will overproduce that pollution. The classic positive externality is research. When I make an invention, if I invent the cathode ray tube, I can accrue rents from the initial invention for a defined period of time, 20 years. And after that, everything that invention made possible, I accrue no rents for. The television set, ultimately, the video conferencing, the very Zoom we're on right now, not directly cathode ray tube technology anymore, but a descendant thereof. And the fact that we can telecommute to work, right? All those things came out of an earlier invention that with the inventor makes no money from. And classically, they underproduce because the direct economic incentive is not there for it. That's where grants make a lot of sense. And it's been calculated a dollar of R&D returns $2 of GDP. And that's exactly an area where a government can and should be engaged. So there's more beyond that, but those are two kind of key critical areas of economic and, let's say, conceptual support for advancement of therapies.
Absolutely. I guess my next question is, so there's a number of government bodies, government agencies that support science. There's obviously the NIH, there's the NSF, DOD, and then there's the newly minted, or I guess a few years ago minted, ARPA-H. ARPA-H is distinct in its sort of mission-focused science and decentralized, hands-off methodology there. Do you see value in the way that ARPA functions versus maybe a traditional NIH grant? Which do you think is more impactful for the advancement of science? A loaded
I
question.
think both matter. I don't have a perspective on which is more impactful. I'm not just being political about it. I haven't thought about it enough to know. But I'm glad that we have multiple avenues of how we're helping to push the field forward. But it's way too little. The scale of what we're doing is orders of magnitude smaller than what we're doing even for cancer, which is just one disease and super important, or suite of diseases, I should say, super important. But there are many other diseases of aging which we might be able to address all simultaneously, including cancers, with efforts in this area. And one thing that's fairly clear is that the scale is well below what it needs to be.
Absolutely. That's the message I bring to every political office that I go to. It's the budget of the NIH is about $50 billion, and we put roughly $400 million towards the biology of aging. And the biology of aging is the driver of what, about 80% of the diseases that kill us. A complete misallocation there. And I do think people in Congress and people in this new administration are starting to understand that. And I'm very hopeful for what's going to be possible in terms of new funding and new focus at these government agencies for longevity research. But yeah, even if they bump it up to how much the National Cancer Institute's getting, I still think it's probably underfunded given the scope of what's at stake here. I'm glad you agree with me on that. In terms of drug development, we talked about the granting bodies. The FDA, like you mentioned, is the FDA, I feel like sometimes is unfairly labeled as the boogeyman here. And some people are very frustrated by what the FDA allows and doesn't allow. Do you see ways for the FDA to help usher in the advent of longevity medicine sooner? At A4LI, we put together a white paper, and I don't know if you've read it or not, but it's called the AAPLM, Advanced Approval Pathway for Longevity Medicine, which kind of mimics what pathways like RMAT create for the regenerative medicine community. And we see that as a possible avenue, even if it doesn't actually accelerate drug development or development timelines. It's a way to encourage more private investment and make it easier for longevity companies to run multiple clinical trials and look at multiple indications. Do you see pathways like that potentially being
Yeah,
useful?
I'd love to read it. I haven't actually read it, so I'd love to read it. This is a field that has a lot of claims that are not substantiated by evidence. And it's actually important to have a regulatory body and a regulatory pathway that is robust and people can trust, so that when you have an approved medicine, you know that the efficacies and safety claims are based in evidence. That's important to maintain. Now, within that, are there accelerated approval pathways that can help adjust the burden of what it costs to get a therapy to market, so that we're able to bring more to patients within that remit of safe and effective? Yeah, in general, those kinds of approaches have made a lot of sense in other. We already have accelerated approval pathways in other parts of the FDA. Do we need a dedicated one for this? I have to read more detail on it to know, but in general, supportive of accelerated approval pathways consistent with what the FDA has been doing in some other fields.
Awesome. I'll send it over once we hop off. I'm curious to get your thoughts. The last thing I want to touch on is the geopolitical implications of longevity medicine. During the Cold War, there were certain races between the Soviet Union and the US, namely the military buildup, the nuclear buildup, the arms race. We're seeing sort of something like similar like that with AI now. And I believe the longevity arms race, quote unquote, is possibly the most beneficial for obviously humanity, but the race that will put the country that wins it in the largest lead. Geopolitical implications of longevity. What are your thoughts on that? Do you see other countries being at the same level as the US? My opinion is that the US has such a robust biomedical research in a private innovation ecosystem that it's very far ahead. But if the government doesn't take decisive action in these next few years, we have a serious chance of losing our position at the top of the global order there.
So I'm not really qualified to talk about much of this beyond the economic angle, which is the value of being an economic powerhouse in an area, which has obviously geopolitical implications. We talked earlier about the numbers that are involved here, that a 10-year extension of healthspan just for the US population is worth $300 trillion. That is not a small number. The GDP of the world, annual GDP of the world, is 100 trillion. So an NPV that is three times the annual GDP of the world for something that is somewhat modest improvement from aging biology, there's enormous economic value on the table here. And of course, the countries that have those industries within them get the economic benefits of that. And it's an industry that I think any country would be extremely lucky to play a part in. And that's why there is a strategic reason for different countries to support work in this area. Your last question around specific countries, again, I'm not really qualified to have much of a view on that. I do know and agree with you that certainly right now, the biomedical clusters in the Boston slash Cambridge, the Bay Area are the strongest in the world. But there are others that are emerging and important to for each country to play to its strengths in this field.
Do you have any other clusters, maybe outside of the US, that you've noticed that you're impressed by?
I think it's probably not a focus for me to comment on right now, but because there are a lot. And so if I mentioned just one or two, then, I'd miss others out. There's something like 200 countries, depending on which list you take, the UN list versus the Olympics list and so on. And probably many of them have activities. And so I wouldn't want to slight a country by leaving them off the list.
I'm trying to get a hot take from you, Michael. I agree with you. I think we're in agreement there that the clusters within the US, and there are emerging clusters too in the US. I think I was just down in North Carolina last week, and the Research Triangle over there is rapidly growing over in Texas, New York, even LA, Seattle. We are in an advantageous position here, but I think you would agree with this too. The government has a role to play and has had a role to play in past biomedical research breakthroughs. And if we want to continue to have the ecosystem that we do, I do believe that the government needs to play an important role there. The last thing, this, I like to end these conversations with a bit of existential hope. Give our listeners something to get them out of bed and be hopeful for in the future. So I guess my question is, Michael, what gets you out of bed? What gets you excited? What gives you hope about the future of humanity?
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about the science side and the kind of hard facts, and all of which it is like exciting, and you need to have that part of your brain on. But then imagine a world where you're able to engage with your loved ones for pick your X years longer, both through better health, you're just in a better state, and through a better lifespan. Imagine a world where, I don't know, a skilled physician is able to continue their work and something they love for another decade or two. Imagine a world where, I don't know, Einstein gets another 2 decades of productivity and what that would mean for us. And there's so much value to life that you can start to imagine the kind of emotional implications of having more of that. We're not talking immortality, but we are talking much longer period potentially for people to do the things that matter to us. It's really a vision that I find inspiring, and I'm happy to make my life's work from here out.
Absolutely. Me too. I always say I want to meet my great grandkids. And that means I probably got to start having kids sooner than I am right now. I'm at zero right now. But I think the idea of nations intermingling and the lessons that our elders can pass on to the younger generation. And like you said, imagine if we had Einstein or Edison or any of the great inventors of the world around for an extra decade or two. I think scientific progress and people's livelihoods would be improved so greatly if we just had those people around for a little longer and in a state where they could contribute. And so that's where I think the health span conversation becomes super important. But I agree with everything you said, Michael. Is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Just, I'm really appreciative of the work that A4LI is doing because, as you would have seen at my ARDD presentation, no social movement succeeds without ultimately grassroots support. And the work you're doing to try and build visibility around this, both on the Hill, but also more broadly with just regular people like you and me, right, is really valuable. Once people understand what's at stake here, I think people come on board, but you got to get the message out in order to do that. So, very grateful for what you're doing in that regard.
I appreciate it, Michael. Same goes to you in Life Biosciences. We are nothing without the industry, that we would be advocating for nothing if there wasn't an industry behind us. And the work that you're doing fuels the work that we do, and hopefully vice versa. And it's a nice little symbiotic relationship we have here. All right. This was a great conversation, Michael. And I look forward to you speaking at our summit next month
See you
and
soon.
all that's to come. And we'll be watching with anticipation for Life Biosciences Phase 1 trial.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Live long and prosper.
Thank you, Michael, for making the time to join us today. And for those of you listening at home, I hope you found this conversation as enlightening and informative as I did. If you have anyone you would like to see make an appearance on our podcast, you can send us your suggestions at info@a4li.org. HFAN will return in a couple of weeks, but until then, let's live long and prosper.